Longtime activist Patricia Hines recently wrote a letter to President Joe Biden in which she talked about how some problems were inherited from other administrations, but others were of his own making. The letter, which was published in the LA Progressive, Common Dreams, and the Greenfield Recorder, emphasized the need for peacemaking rather than defense spending and war making. She spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking her if she'd ever written a letter to the president before.
Yes, actually once before, but I think this one was a little tougher and even more critical than 2 years ago or so.
So it sounds like in talking about the violence, as Martin Luther King might say, pervaded by the United States and the war making and the defense spending, and it sounds like you're asking the president to give up the empire, in a sense. Did you say that?
And just become a companion country, a brother and sister country with all others.
That would kind of be unthinkable to the U.S. foreign policy establishment, do you think?
Yes, of course it is unthinkable at this point. Now, maybe in the 1960s, when John F. Kennedy was negotiating with Khrushchev, where they set up a separate line of communication, actually involved the Pope, John the 23rd at the time, whom both respected, Khrushchev as well. And essentially, there was some sanity in the negotiations and the dialogue, and almost a friendship, I would say, that formed. And it was about, first of all, dismantling nuclear weapons, but preliminarily to that, stopping above-ground nuclear testing. They both agreed on that, but that wasn't all that they were meeting about. And that came into effect. Kennedy was assassinated, and of course, many people think the CIA was involved in it, before they could go farther. But their intention was to eliminate nuclear weapons and actually develop more of a civilized relationship with each other, being the two big empires at the time. And had that been able to go forward, then we might have a different model of country, which is not having to be the largest military in history. And also, we would not have militarized our democracy in the way that has happened since. But we had a chance then.
What about the détente of the Henry Kissinger era? Was that sort of similar to what you're talking about, or was it qualitatively different?
I think the man has too tarnished a record to be able to be, in a sense, saved. Not just his image, but you know, his consequences in action. Are you talking about the reach out to China? What was?
No, I think the détente was a reference to the relations with the Soviet Union. Sort of this understanding that big powers have their interests, and you know, that has to be respected, at least in a strategic way.
Like they're the big guys in the world.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you can sort of wipe off the planet, the little guys.
Well, you're right. The world is a chessboard, and for the big powers to play with, that kind of
engaged in Vietnam at the time, bombing them, North Vietnam, to smithereens, and also he was behind the assassination of Allende. So he has these kind of alternative, extremely bad, and interestingly good aspects to himself. But I think ultimately his record is one of an evildoer. This is how I see Kissinger. But the question you're getting at is big powers who deal with each other differently than they do with smaller countries. For example, right now, parts of our State Department, I'd say those closest to Biden, and of course DOD, they are itching for a confrontation with China. It's minimized, I would say, in the frontline news, which is mainly about Gaza and Israel at this point. But this has been going on for a good 2 years, I would say.
And well, the pivot, they talked about that a few years ago.
Yes.
When Obama was in office.
Yeah. Under Obama, the pivot to Asia. And that pivot was all about, it was the power pivot, very obviously, and still very conscious of animosity of between big powers. And in this case, I think China was foremost in that. NATO has even set up, with our encouragement, a NATO of the Pacific. We have surrounded China, surrounded them through the partners and militarized relationships with other partners. You know, there's a saying, for someone with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And our country has one instinct and solution. I mean, our national government, which is to pull out that hammer and use it on wherever there is a disagreement with us, or wherever there is a country doing something on behalf of or against another country that we don't like. And all we know to do, we don't know diplomacy. We don't express it. We don't.
Although the way the U.S. officials put it, it's as though the U.S. is acting reasonably and responsibly, and these other countries are rogue nations that are upsetting the international order.
Yeah, it's good propaganda. And I think it plays well in our major media and in our Western nation friends. But it does not play well across the rest of the world. And there's alternative press, respectable press, like Haaretz, across the rest of the world, which has very different messages and also sees the U.S. Differently than you just expressed, you know, the way the U.S. sees itself.
Have you gotten a response from the White House to your
No, I have not.
Because sometimes they, you know, they might send a form letter, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you for your concern, and thank you for expressing your views, that kind of thing.
I know, that sort of tepid response that you get from every congressional and every politician that you write.
Yeah.
Not yet, but I'm not done, you know, with trying to get this through.
So it would take quite a bit of unraveling, both domestic and internationally, to get the kind of shift in consciousness, I guess, that you're talking about.
The shift in what
consciousness, you know.
Consciousness, yes.
This idea that you don't have to be top dog all the time, this idea that it's not necessary to have automatic weapons and this kind of thing.
Or that's your automatic response, is to use a weapon rather than a word. But one other thing that in the letter to him that I tried to point out and in a sense raise some awareness is the fact that we are so egregious and so above any other Western country in terms of the number of both guns but also guns being used, that Americans are 10 times more likely to be shot to death than people in other wealthy countries, and with homicides, suicides, and mass shootings. And these have skyrocketed in his administration. The massacres, the mass murders have skyrocketed in the last 3 years in this country. And in 2020, more children and teens were killed by firearms than any other cause. So my question to him was, don't these sound like war statistics? And they do to me, and they do to many people. But it's rare to see anyone in his administration making the connections between our country's record-breaking gun violence at home and our country's record-breaking military weapons sales across the world to democracies as well as autocracies. They've grown dramatically over the past 5 years. So isn't it possible that the U.S. global culture of weapons and militarism, with our 800 or so military bases around the world and our long and persistent history of war, isn't it possible it rebounds back to infect our own violent culture here at home? And Chalmers Johnson had a word for that rebounding back. Do you remember it?
Yeah, it's kind of on the tip of my tongue. It's not flashback, but blowback, something like
blowback.
That.
Blowback. Yeah. Yes, I think it was blowback.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't take too much intelligence or insight to actually see that there's an equation of some sort between the weaponized domestic world here at home and the weaponized policy that we have across the world. I thought that might be a hook, one hook in.
It's interesting, you know, some politicians like the late Dianne Feinstein and Hillary Clinton made a big issue out of guns and gun control, and yet they never made the connection with U.S. foreign policy.
Exactly. Good point. And also the White House, for the first time, established an office on gun violence prevention. But in fact, I think it's had no impact, number one. But number two, again, no insight into any connection between our country's culture of violence, especially with guns, and our country's international policy, which is shoot first and ask questions later.
But again, the propaganda aspect that you mentioned earlier puts forth that the foreign policy as almost a defense of freedom and democracy everywhere. And, you know, the U.S. would never use violence recklessly. And they would say, for example, even in Gaza right now, the administration is trying to get the Israelis to tone it down.
Well, then I agree. Then why do we make their violence possible with our weapons? And the executive office has bypassed Congress to continue sending billions to Israel, and as well as billions of dollars worth of weapons to sustain their war. So it's saying one thing but doing another. And I think it's what's being done that is the way that we should judge our country.
It doesn't seem to bother the U.S. officials that most of the world is totally against what's happening. I guess because they feel they have the power to ignore it.
I think that's it. And I don't even know if they pay attention to it. Do they read anything other than the media that quotes them? And so I feel
right. You hear about the right wing echo chamber, but it certainly exists in other parts of the political spectrum, let's say.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think there's also a sort of egotism about thinking that we know better, we are smarter, or that because we are the most powerful military, that we are also the most powerful and authentic democracy. They used to be conflated, but I think it's very evident that they've pulled apart and that we are deeply in trouble as a democracy, that we are extremely weak and getting weaker as a democracy. And while we still have the military strength that we brag about and hold out as if it's somewhat synonymous with being a democracy.
Yeah, there's always that tension. There's always has been that tension between whether the country is going to be a democratic republic or an empire, and the forces of empire appear to have won out so far.
Yes, and they seem contradictory to try to be both at the same time. And it seems that, as you said, the forces of empire most definitely have prevailed. And at the same time, within our country, it seems that the empire has many cracks in it and is potentially falling apart. And just a couple of things, 40%, and this is from the Poor People's Campaign, 40% of people are either poor or close to being poor, are low income.
One paycheck away from disaster, kind of.
That's the other thing, like a hospitalization, a $400 paycheck away from disaster. So the sort of social security and safety nets of our country are really torn. And so the consequences of things like that, do people want to come out and vote if no one cares about them? And just as one example, I think we survive in this country because many people are still kind to each other. And so little local safety nets exist where, you know, you're giving food to a food shelter and or cans of food and a little side donation from, you know, in a community to basically help create a little bit more housing for the homeless. I think there's so much generosity that you can focus locally and then sort of miss the point that this is what we pay our taxes for. These things should be provided by our governments, not to discourage charity, but to say they owe it to us in terms of the taxes that we pay. And so I think the more that those democratic social safety nets and programs are riddled with holes, I think the greater the spirit or any spirit of democracy is going to be whittled away. And, you know, it's just easy to take a snapshot of this in terms of dollars to look at the discretionary budget of the country each year. This is where not that things are obligated to pay like Social Security, Medicare, but it's all the different agencies, education, health, welfare, etc. And altogether, the defense and the national security basically gets maybe 60% out of the 100%. And then the rest is chiseled away at. And so you never have enough funding being given, let's say, to house everyone in this country. And the same to keep hunger at bay. I mean, there should not be hunger in such a wealthy country. So I think just a mirror on the discretionary budget tells you everything about the whittling away, the weakening of democracy.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
Well, let me just look at my last paragraph, brief paragraph to my January 2024 letter to the president. My wish for you in 2024 is to imbibe this wisdom and act on it. What is hateful to yourself, do not do to your fellow man or woman or child. That is the core of the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran, and other religious traditions, as well as humanist. Make it your own, end the U.S. addiction to war, and save your country's soul and your own. This is a man who goes to church every Sunday. He needs to save his soul.
The golden rule.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's even better expressed this way, as I did. What is hateful to yourself, do not do to your fellow man. I think there's something more authentic and more graspable about that, rather than do unto others as you would have others do unto you. What is hateful to yourself, do not do to your fellow man.
Somehow, considering Biden's history, I don't see a big shift there. But
no.
Sometimes people change by necessity.
But sometimes they change after they've been in office.
Oh, like those Israeli intelligence officials when they commented in that movie, The Gatekeepers.
Yes, yes.
Kind of like that.
But I do want to mention that while this war is in the foreground of our news, not the war in Ukraine, which has killed many, many, many more people, and also the buildup to war with China, that the Israeli publication Haaretz, a liberal publication, very respected by those who read it, is worth for anyone who wants to follow a different perspective on that war, is worth subscribing to. And for free, you can get a synopsis of news. Subscribing, you get sort of fuller articles.
And we do get to hear sometimes their reporters or people who write for them, like Gideon Levy.
Yeah, Gideon Levy just was on Democracy Now! And just such a clear snapshot into the Israeli media. And it's really absolute propaganda so that Israeli people don't get any version of this war, but also the rest of the world's perspective on the war from Israeli media.
But they also, I've heard people who've been there say that, you know, the population, you know, maybe because of the propaganda, is extremely racist at this point.
Yes, but the surveys have conveyed that the majority of citizens are racist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, support the war. And the rate of death in that war, by many who study this, is apparently higher than any war, certainly in this century, but also it's possible in the 20th century. Such an intensity of killing.
Yeah, usually the Israelis have that formula where they'll kill 10 times as many Palestinians as the Palestinians have killed Israelis. And this time they've gone way, way beyond that.
Beyond that. And when you consider that in the first decade of the 21st century, there were first decade of possibly spilling over beyond 2010, there were five, I think it was five different brief wars waged by Israel on Gaza. And this was when there were nonviolent protests on the part of the Gazans. And also there was an admission at that time that they would allow enough supplies to come into Gaza just to keep them alive. And I learned recently in reading an article from, I think it was 1995, and it was during Clinton's administration. It was a project for economic development in Palestine, and Vice President Gore and an associate that he had selected started this effort to build an economy, support an economy in Palestine. And what happened was that because everything has to come into Gaza through Israel, that Israel held up all of what was needed for the particular development projects that had been planned with Gaza to build their economy. And consequently, the effort was stymied by Israelis who did not want the Gazan economy to develop and the Gaza to develop as a thriving is you know, exaggerated, but as a sustainable economy and country. So they've been blocked for
although if you go back a couple of decades, their economy was a lot better than in recent years.
Yes. Well, I think it's intentional on the part of Israel to actually just keep them at survival level. That was more recently that I've read that. So at this point, they simply want to eliminate just to sustain, keep them alive, but eliminate. It's a very murky mirror within which to imagine what the outcome of this will be.
Patricia Hines is a retired environmental engineer and professor of environmental health and currently a member of the board of directors of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice. She spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on January 30th, 2024.